Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the latest Mark Leverage podcast. Lovely to have you along. This one is the April to May 2023 edition. And since I spoke to you last, I haven't been very well actually. At the beginning of March, I went down with the dreaded lurgy. Yes, COVID, you think it's gone, don't you? And just as you think it's disappeared, it comes back and bites you. Fortunately, I wasn't particularly poorly with it, unlike my wife, who was very poorly with it, but I was okay. I just had a slight runny nose and a little tickly cough, and that was about the sum total of it, and after a week it was gone. But it just goes to show that you can never let your guard down, because I did have a booking which I had to postpone, and I'll be doing it a bit later, but really that was the only damage that was done from that point of view, so that was quite lucky. But I hope you haven't had a recurrence of COVID, and if you have, that you get over it quickly. So, after that medical review, let's get on with the podcast, and let's ask you a question. If I said to you, what constitutes good magic in your eyes, what would you say? Because I think there's probably quite a big difference, isn't there, between what we as magicians think makes good magic and what perhaps lay people think constitutes good magic. I think for magicians, we love complex either plots or methods. There's something, because we know so much perhaps about magic methodology and magic in general, anything that is a little bit intricate and convoluted and complex kind of tickles our fancy, doesn't it? I mean, you look at some card routines that are full of amazing moves and sleights. And for a lot of magicians, this is incredibly captivating. They love to watch top exponents of card magic strut their stuff. But the truth of the matter is, does that actually make for good magic? It probably doesn't in a broader sense. And if you were to talk to a layperson, then I suspect that if you said, oh, what's your favourite magic trick you've ever seen? Then they would probably choose something quite simple, I suspect. I mean, it's always said, isn't it, that the best magic tricks are the ones which you can, the plot of which you can describe in basically one short sentence. A signed card put into the centre of a pack jumps to the top. You know, that sort of thing. And a lot of classic tricks are like that. Steel rings link and unlink themselves. These are the classic tricks which are easily remembered and easily described. But a lot of the time they are not necessarily ones that magicians would say would be their favourites. They might use them, but say, oh, I do those for lay people. But if you went to a magic convention and you went to see a close-up gala show and somebody came and did a very standard, ambitious card routine, you wouldn't be captivated by that, would you, as a magician? No, you'd be probably a bit disappointed. Well, you did it very well, but, well, it's just the ambitious card. Whereas if somebody comes along and does a version of the ambitious card that fools you because he's using a method that you hadn't expected and that was perhaps more complex than the normal method used, then suddenly you get very excited by this. Oh, it was amazing. He did this fantastic version of the ambitious card. So I think it's quite interesting the way that magic for lay people and magic for magicians varies. And I know I've always considered myself to be at a disadvantage when entertaining magicians, because a lot of the magic that I do, in fact, all of the magic that I do really, is aimed at lay people. It's not necessarily aimed at fooling magicians. Okay, some of them might fool magicians as well, and if they do, happy bonus. But it's not the sole reason that I devise something. It's not the reason I put together tricks in the way that I do. I'm looking to say, can I do this for lay people? Will they find this interesting? Will they want to watch this? Is it funny enough for them? Is the magic clear and obvious and entertaining and engaging? So that's the way I've always approached it. But of course, because magicians like more complex things, sometimes I've always felt in that, certainly in the past, that I've struggled a bit to find things that would fool them or which would be particularly interesting. They might be interested in taking it and using it for lay people themselves. So in other words, magic that I sell that's practical, people then take that and use it. But at a magic convention, if I was to go and do some of it, they wouldn't necessarily be enthralled by it. Like it up to a point, and that's as far as it would go. So for you, what is the right sort of definition of good magic. Have a think about it and see what you come up with. Now, as most listeners to this podcast will probably know, back in October of last year, I retired from my association with Magic Scene magazine, both as editor and co-owner. And although I have no longer any input to the magazine, I of course still get it and read it. But it's quite interesting because, rather like when you receive your copy, you don't know what's going to be in it. Well, nor do I anymore. And I rather like it. It's quite refreshing to open it up and see what the latest articles are all about. And in the March issue, I was particularly interested by an article by Paul Brook on strolling mentalism, as some of the conclusions that he explained in the article, I was surprised by. Now, as a strolling mentalist, Paul is very keen to disassociate himself from close-up strolling magicians, because he explains that he's often booked as an alternative to a strolling magician. And so the material that he uses needs to try and make sure that it's as different as possible to what a strolling magician might do. And of course, there are a lot of mental card effects, and Paul used to have a lot of these in his act. And he started to come across a bit of a problem where on a couple of occasions he had bookers who complained because they didn't like the fact that he was doing, as they saw it, card tricks. Now, although the material that he was actually doing, and he knew that it was mentalism, it just happened to use playing cards, to lay people, this wasn't the case. He'd become a magician rather than a mentalist, and his drawing duplications and predictions and other stuff, they were much more impressed by that. As soon as he went to as they saw it, card tricks, he suddenly became an ordinary magician. And for some of the bookers, since they specifically had booked him in order to make sure that they didn't get a strolling magician, because they'd had magicians before, suddenly he was not delivering what they'd hoped he would. And so as a result of that, he gradually and eventually completely removed playing cards from the props that he used. And as a result, he claims that he's had much more success and been taken more seriously as a mentalist. Now, I find this fascinating because obviously I have no experience, I'm not a strolling mentalist, and so I've never experienced how lay people react to or would react to me if they thought that I was. But I would never have thought that using playing cards, just the actual physical objects, would have been such a problem. Because you could say, well, depending on what you do with that, surely that's what matters. But apparently, according to Paul anyway, and the experiences that he had, that wasn't the case. Now, I suspect that the truth is that he remembers the one or two occasions when people complained about that, because you do tend to remember that, don't you? If somebody complains about something goes wrong, you nearly always remember that more than all the many, many things that go right. It leaves a more of an impression. And so it could be that there are 99% of his bookers couldn't care less whether he used playing cards, as long as he was apparently reading their minds while using playing cards. But because he had one or two people who actually picked on the cards and said, oh no, we didn't want a card magician, we wanted a mentalist, someone who reads minds, then he took the view, well, the easiest thing to do here is just take the cards out, even though he did love the card material. So I think that's quite interesting. Now, whether this is just a strolling mentalist, which is what he is, where the comparison is made, or whether a stand-up or parlour mentalist feels the same, presumably they do. It's not just because it's strolling, is it? That strolling magic and strolling mentalism are too close to each other, whereas stand-up mentalism and stand-up magic are very different? Maybe they are. Maybe they can't. It's easier to differentiate one to the other when it's a stand-up performance rather than a close-up one. But if you're a strolling mentalist, I'd love to know whether you've had the same experience. And if you do, send me an email and let me know whether you found playing cards equally to be a problem for you. I was reading Bob Gill's column in the Magic Circular, the December edition, the other day, and he was talking about political correctness, or the lack of it, in comedy and in magic. And he was cited the example, a very rare example indeed, of the Edinburgh Fringe, one of the venues, cancelling Jerry Sadowitz's show because they felt that the material that he was using was not something they wished to be associated with. And Bob was saying, well, this is extraordinary. I mean, of all the places where you would imagine just about anything goes, surely it is the Fringe, is it not? That's the whole point, trying experimental stuff and being a bit close to the knuckle. The people who go to these shows, that's kind of what they're hoping for, isn't it? That's kind of what they expect to see. And if they don't, if it's all very bland and middle of the road, then quite often people will be disappointed. But he nevertheless was commenting on the general feeling about whether this is a good thing or not. And it's true, you do find that these days there are so many groups, many of them minority groups, who as entertainers we start to feel we've got to be careful not to offend by the language that we use or the things that we imply. And although there are some performers, of course, who say, do you know what? I really don't care. If they don't like me, they can go hang themselves. I don't care. I'm going to say what I'm going to say. And there are one or two people who can get away with that, perhaps. But I think for most of us, particularly if you're a semi-pro or even as a pro and you're doing shows for money, the last thing you really want to do, if you want to continue to work for money, is to upset people. And the question is, though, how far do you have to go in order to provide an act that is sufficiently funny and interesting, perhaps, and not totally and completely bland? Where do you draw that line? Because sometimes it's quite difficult to know, isn't it? I was thinking back over my own material, and I know that some of the routines that I published in the early 80s, for instance, one in particular I can think of, where when you read the patter that I was using at the time, it makes me absolutely cringe. How on earth could I have said those things? They weren't meant to be insulting. It was just what was said at the time. And it's only looking at it in sort of hindsight, looking at it now, that I feel, oof, gosh, well, I wouldn't use that now, anything like that now. And I think the first time that I really noticed myself or pulling myself up slightly short was with children's shows. It's just simple things like I suddenly found myself, I was talking to the kids about something and part of the patter referred to mummy and daddies, or mums and dads. And then I thought, should I say mums and dads? Or because there are lots of one-parent families around these days, am I being insensitive by saying mums and dads? I wasn't meant like that, but I felt slightly hampered, as if I really shouldn't be making that assumption that they've all got mums and dads, even though probably most of them had, they might not all have. And then other things like, you know, the old gag where you have a kid up to help and you just gently hold their elbow and you push with your fingers and it makes their elbow bend and their hand comes up and it looks like they want to shake hands with you. She goes, oh, hello. And you give them a quick shake of the hand and let the hand drop down. Then you pull on their arm again and it shoots up again and you shake the hand again. It's an old classic gag. And suddenly you realise, should I be doing that anymore now? Because I've got to hold this kid's arm. Is this inappropriate? It's not meant to be inappropriate. It's just a gag. But should I not be doing that anymore? And then just repositioning children when they're up to help. They wander and sometimes they stand in the wrong place, holding them by the shoulders and just gently moving them. Are you not allowed to do that anymore? Or is it okay? And then I think there are lots of sort of patter lines and behavioural things that we do as performers, which sometimes you can pull yourself up short and think, is that still okay for me to say that? Is it still all right for me to do that? And depending on where you personally draw the line, and more importantly, perhaps, where you think the audience will be drawing the line, depending on who the group is that you're entertaining, may decide on where that line is drawn. And for some groups, it'll be drawn in a different place to others, of course, as has always been the case with patter. But these days, I think there are so many more things that we can't, perhaps, or don't want to include, just in case we offend people. It's sometimes difficult to know what to do and what to say. I was having a Zoom chat recently with one of my eClub Elite members, somebody who actually he's been a customer of mine for decades. In fact, he's more than that, really. He's a good friend, too. And we were talking about various things, and he's just turned 60. And he was telling me that he does a lot of kids shows, and he was saying to me that he's finding it increasingly difficult to lug the heavy cases that he needs with all his kids show stuff in and out of venues. Now, he doesn't actually drive, so he needs to go on public transport. And so he has to go sometimes quite big distances with these heavy cases. And he was trying to work out how he could reduce the weight and the size of the carry-alls in order to make sure that he can continue to do it. And I know I've had the same problem. I've always had a slightly dodgy back. So having a roll-on table with my kids show and games and everything in it, which made it very heavy, became an issue to the point where I started to take a flatbed trolley in order, if I had a long distance to go from the car into a venue, then I could at least didn't have to carry it. I could drag it along on the trolley. But there are all sorts of things, not just kid show stuff, of course. There are all sorts of things that as we get older, we find a bit more difficult. Another friend of mine, the issue that he had was he wanted to do a routine and it used a marked deck. So he got the marked deck and discovered that he couldn't read the markings on the back without putting his glasses on. Unfortunately, he needs glasses for close work, but not for looking at a distance. So normally when he's performing, even when he's doing close-up, he doesn't wear glasses because he's looking at a distance at the spectators and so on. But of course, as soon as he needed to look at the car backs, it was a bit of a blur and he would have had to put his glasses on. So he couldn't actually use that particular marked deck and therefore couldn't do the routine. Now for me, it's the other way around. I need glasses for a long distance viewing, but up close, I'm okay, I don't need them. So I don't wear glasses normally when I'm performing, but it does mean that if I look across the room and trying to see a table number that's several tables away, I can't read it. I have to go over closer unless I put my glasses on. So these things mean that you have to adapt and change the way that you work in order to make sure that you can still continue to do things. And I've had various customers who have asked me about certain tricks that I'm selling and they're thinking of buying. And they'll say things like, oh, you know, these days I've got arthritis in my fingers. I can't manipulate things as well. Do I have to do much sleight of hand with this? It is a genuine issue. And although younger people say, oh, for goodness sake, you're old fogies. But it happens to us all. If you stay in magic for long enough, things that you could do in your 20s and 30s and 40s, perhaps, when you get older, then sometimes these things can become, well, either impossible or certainly a lot more difficult. And so you find yourself having to make workarounds. If there's a move that you can no longer do, say a card move that you can no longer do, okay, can't manage that anymore, let's find another move that I can do. And so I can continue doing the trick, should be, I think, the approach that you take. I mean, the ultimate example of triumphing over disability, of course, is Wayne Dobson. I mean, he is incredible. The way over the years he's had to adapt everything that he does to a totally almost hands-off approach as far as he's concerned is a testament to his creativity and his willingness to look for methods that will still work, will still fool, will still entertain within the limitations that that he now has. So there are lots of things I think that we need to look at as we get older. And I do think it rather than just giving up or, oh, I can't do that trick anymore, I think sometimes a bit of thought, change of method, think around the problem. What is it that I can't do? What am I actually trying to achieve with this difficult move? Okay, is there a gimmick I can use instead? Is there some other simpler form of the slight that will do equally well so I can continue doing the trick? Can I adapt the trick, the presentation of the trick, so that that move is no longer needed at all? There are all sorts of workarounds. You just have to think about it and be prepared to put a little bit of thought into trying to make it so you continue to do tricks that you love. Now, the fact that you're listening to this podcast presumably means that you are quite happy to get information by listening to it. Some people are very video oriented. They like everything visually presented to them. Others like audio. A lot of people, of course, like both. But there seems to be quite an increase in the number of podcasts, not just in magic, but just in general terms. Now you think about all the sporting podcasts, entertainment, general entertainment ones, news podcasts, all of these specialist programs, which tend to be sometimes minority interests, sometimes big interests, but with a narrow focus. These are all very, very popular. And it seems to me there's every day, hardly a day goes by, in fact, every day there's a new one coming on stream. So it's great that there are so many things. And I wondered why there are so many podcasts. I think it's probably that, to be honest with you, we're all quite busy. And sometimes we haven't got time to concentrate, sit down and concentrate on learning perhaps something by giving it our full attention. And so if you can listen to a podcast, you can be doing something else, cooking the dinner, going for a run, sitting in the garden half asleep, you know, whatever else it is that you want to do, you can do it as well as listening to a podcast at the same time. Now, of course, traditionally, people would have just had a radio and just listened to the radio. But of course, the benefit of a podcast is that it is a specialist, often has a specialist area of interest that you might really like. And in the case of magic, the magic podcasts, of course, are talking all about magic and magic related themes. And so it's nice to have an entire podcast dedicated to that. Now, alongside podcasts, I would put audiobooks, because I think the same thing applies. To sit down and read a book of information, a fact, sometimes people just don't have the time to do it. But if they're commuting to work for, let's say, half an hour every day, and they can put on an audiobook, they can learn and listen all at the same time as driving. And it feels like a productive and an interesting way to get the information. So with this in mind, gradually over the last few years, I've been producing my ebooks, the advice ones, that is, in audiobook format. The Professional Worker series, there are six different titles, all of which relate to various aspects of magic. None of them have any tricks in, they all are all advice based. So you've got things like Going Walkabout, Marketing Yourself, The Table Magician, Trade Show Magic, Learning from Experience. All of these are now available as podcasts. In fact, the Learning from Experience one has just been added. And for £10, you can have me read the entire book to you, so that whatever you're doing and wherever you are, it's a really nice way to get the information. It's almost easier in a way to learn like that, because although you are concentrating up to a point, you don't have to give it your total and complete undivided attention in order to get the information in. And certainly if you listen to these more than once, two or three run-throughs on a commute, and all the information that is read to you, most of it will have gone in, almost without you meaning it to, or without you needing to concentrate too much. So I think audiobooks are a really good way to go. And if you haven't had a look at my range of audiobooks, there are currently about six or seven of them, then do go and have a look. Because they're only £10 each, and I think they're a really nice way to get information that you might find really helpful and useful. One of the real fascinations, I think, with magic is that you never reach the end of it, do you? There's always something new, something fresh, something that you haven't come across before to pique your interest and for you to get enthusiastic about and to investigate. And I think when you do an act, whether that's a stand-up act where it's a very set routine, or whether it's a series of tricks that you carry with you when you're doing strolling magic, introducing something new into your current set is actually quite stressful. Because if you've been doing, let's say, strolling magic, you've got a set of tricks which you carry with you normally, and you've been doing them for years, they become very familiar, don't they? You know exactly what reaction they're going to get, you're used to doing them, you can relax with them. But of course, to do the same tricks and no new tricks ever being introduced can get a bit boring. And sometimes you'll see a trick, or you'll either read it, you'll see it online, you'll buy something, and you think, oh, that would be brilliant for my act. So you get the trick and you practice it up and you think, right, I'm going to put it in my strolling repertoire. And you put it in your pocket and you go out. And of course, the most common experience, certainly in my view anyway, the most common experience that I have is that I suddenly realize that if I'm not careful, if I don't do that new trick fairly soon, I'm probably not going to do it at all. Even though I'm doing lots of tables or lots of different groups in an evening, I keep finding myself going back to the tried and tested and the familiar, because that I know works. Why would I want to take the stress and the chance of doing a new thing that I'm not used to, which might not actually work, which might not get the reaction I hope that it will? Well, of course, this is ridiculous. Yeah, if you were to take this attitude permanently, you would never ever introduce a new trick, and that would be a bit dull. And also, sometimes I find that if I can get that new trick done, and if it goes reasonably well the first time, and I start to get used to doing it, then it eventually becomes one of the regular ones anyway. It's just that it's not going to be obviously familiar right from the start. So it's getting over this hurdle. It's almost like a mental barrier that something new might not go well. You know, you get excited about it in theory, but when you actually get in front of people and you're being paid money to actually work, you don't want to take a chance on it going wrong. But I think it is a good thing to force that yourself to do it and to put something in. And if you're doing, say, a stage act where you've got, I don't know, let's say there are 10 items, then usually people would say, well, put the new trick in between two very familiar things, somewhere in the middle of the act. So not at the beginning when you're just getting warmed up and when you're trying to get the audience on your side, not at the end when you're building to the big crescendo finale, but somewhere in the middle. Whereas if it doesn't quite gel, the trick before and the trick after will make up for it, and it's not creating a bad start or a weak finish. And I think doing it in this way, you can gradually introduce new material. The problem, though, that I find with strolling magic is that I carry everything basically I need to perform on my person. So I have no spare pocket space. Every bit of pocket is taken up with something that I use. There's no dead wood in there, because why would you carry something around you never use? So for a new trick, it's either got to be using something that I'm already carrying so that I don't have to take any fresh pocket space up with extra props, or I'm going to have to take something out of my current repertoire in order to get the new trick in. And that is where there's a real leap of faith. Ooh, which of my regular items, all of which I love, by the way, am I going to take out and not take with me in order to take this new tried and untried and untested trick? Which one am I going to take out? And that's almost worse than just doing the trick in the first place, is deciding what I'm not going to take with me. There was one occasion when I actually forgot a prop. And it was only something very simple. It's just a regular deck of cards. That's all it was. But it cut out several tricks. And it made me realize how I rely so heavily on specific tricks to do at specific times in my strolling sets, and that not to have it really threw me completely. Well, if I take one of these things out to put a new trick in, will I be able to cope with not having my regular, not having the sponge balls in my pocket? All of a sudden I've left them behind in order to do something different. I know it's ridiculous. You should be able to do any of this, of course. And once you do it, and if it goes okay, then you get used to it anyway. And if it doesn't go okay, and after an evening you think, not for me, you can always take that new trick out and put the old one back in again. But I think having a little turnover material is healthy. Keeps it fresh, keeps it lively. And it's something that I think we should all do, even though it feels a bit painful at the time. When lay people find out that you're a magician and they get to chat to you a bit about it, sometimes they say to you, oh, how did you get started? And did you have somebody who inspired you, who you looked up to when you were young? And I've often find that quite a difficult question to answer, really, because from a personal perspective, I don't think there was any one person in my youth whose body of work I was completely besotted with and which provided an impetus and a stimulation for me in my own work. Although there have been individual moments, magical moments, tricks, or occasions where I have been inspired, and I thought it might be quite interesting to just talk about five things that came to mind when I was thinking about this. Moments where I was particularly moved by magic and impressed by it. And these are in no particular order, but the first one was at an IBM convention when Tommy Wonder was on the close-up show, and he got me out of the audience to sit up with him for one of the routines. And he was doing his cup and ball routine, where he takes the cup out of a bag, and the bag's got a tassel and a ball on the end. And thanks to his wonderful routining and absolutely incredible misdirection, even though I was a magician, he kept misdirecting me and loading the ball under the cup, and eventually the whole bag goes under the cup. And it's hilarious, and it was just left such an impression on me, because I was determined that he was not going to misdirect me, and the more I tried not to be misdirected, the more he misdirected me. I mean, he was an absolute master, and that particular routine has stuck with me ever since he first did it to me. The second one would be the Pendragon substitution trunk. I've always found the subtrunk, when it's not done well, not a very good or impressive illusion. When people get inside the box, the other one person stands on the top, they raise a curtain, there's a lot of jiggling around, it seems to take forever, and then suddenly the curtain drops and the two people have changed places. The way the Pendragons did it, it was just so fast. But not only was it fast, but the way that they grabbed the curtain, if you like, in the middle, created almost an optical illusion. One minute one of them was there, and what seemed like literally a split second later, that had changed the other person. It seemed absolutely instantaneous. And I did see it live once, but the first time I saw it, it was on a television magic special. And I can remember I had it recorded, and I slowed the recording right down. It was a VHS tape, and I slowed it right down, frame by frame. And even with it slowed down frame by frame, there was no flash. It was absolutely perfect. And I thought that was the best rendition of that particular illusion, but one of the best illusions I'd ever seen. It really was impressive. Still on the subject of illusions, when David Copperfield came to the UK, went to see him at, I think it was Olympia, and I was really moved and impressed by his flying illusion. The choreography, the music, the brilliant combination of methodology, it just looks incredible. It's almost dreamlike in the way that he apparently flies around, and I was hugely impressed by that. A lot of Copperfield's magic is great, but that one actually moved me. It's a combination of the visual spectacle and the music combined, which really left a lasting impression with me. When I was very young, first starting in magic when I was about 8, 9, 10, Johnny Hart was the young magician of the day. And I remember he was on television a fair bit, and his motorbiking budgerigars, where he had a set of billiard balls he had produced, budgerigars in between his fingers, left a huge impression with me. I wanted to be him. That was the nearest I got to being inspired by somebody. And I wanted to be him for a while, and wanted to do the sort of stagey type things at that stage of my career. But the thing with the budgerigars really, really was amazing. And it was, of course, it was one of his signature pieces. And very impressive, I always thought. And the final one was Bob Reed. I booked Bob to come to my first British Close-Up Magic Symposium in 1989. And we had Bob do a 90-minute show at the end of the day. and he was absolutely outstanding. He was incredibly funny. His magic was full of surprises. He kept catching you off guard. And his creativity, the way he did everything, was just a level above everybody else that I'd seen up to that point. And I really loved his show. And we did used to record the symposium events. And he was the only performer who insisted that we turn the cameras off. So I never even had a personal copy of that particular 90-minute show. But despite that fact and how long ago it was, I can still remember it. So no individual perhaps inspired me completely, but all those five moments of magic certainly did. Back at the end of February, I was booked to do a Zoom lecture for IBM Ring number 9, which is the one in Atlanta, Georgia. And they asked me to if I could put together a lecture featuring information on strolling magic and also on table magic. Well, yes, I could. Now, of course, I've got a lot of information about all of this, but I decided to put together a specific 2-hour lecture for them, in which I spent the first hour talking about strolling magic, where there are no tables and where you're doing mix and mingle effectively. And then the second hour talking about techniques to do table magic, both in restaurants and in dinner functions, because I think there is a difference not only between table magic and strolling magic, but also with tables, the difference between doing magic in restaurant tables and magic at dinner function tables. And I also explained 8 suitable routines which people could do pretty much in both situations, but it's all designed for that type of work anyway. Loads of people came. It was great. I really enjoyed it, despite the fact that because of the time difference I was starting at midnight. But it was really good fun. And I thought, well, since I've gone to all the trouble to put this lecture together with all the information and all the magic, I've decided to do it again and make it generally available. So I'm putting on a Zoom lecture on the 9th of May, Tuesday the 9th of May at 7:30 British time. And that's in the evening, obviously. And I'm going to be doing the same thing again for anybody who wishes to register. I'm calling it the Commercial Close-Up Refresher Session, because for those people who've already got some experience with this, I'm hoping that the information I'll impart will be certainly a refresher. It'll remind you of things perhaps you might have forgotten, or given you alternative ideas to things that you're currently doing. And then for people who are fairly new to it, it will hopefully provide a lot of very important information that they can take away and they can do. Plus, of course, there are 8 routines. So there's some really nice magic in there, and all of the magic that I show comes from my own working repertoire. So it's all commercial stuff that you'll be able to do. So the cost of attending is £10, but anybody who registers before the end of April will have, provided that they turn up to the event on the 9th of May, will receive after the event a voucher worth £10. So effectively the lecture is free because they can buy something with the £10. And so the answer is, of course, to get your booking in early. And as I've mentioned before with these things, the great thing about a Zoom lecture is the fact that everybody gets a front row seat. You know, it's for close-up magic, it's an ideal format. And unlike when you go to a magic club room, where if you're anything from the second row, further back than the second row, you often can't see, or you're too far away to get detail of certain things, with Zoom, it's not the case. With the close-up shots, you're able to hopefully see the detail, and therefore learn all the magic as well as you want to. So do come along. It'd be lovely to. And the great thing I also love about Zoom is whenever I do these, we get people from all over the world coming. And that's another big advantage. It's not just people in one locality. It can be from anywhere. So whether you're in America, whether you're in Asia, whether you're in Europe or in the UK, do come and join me on the 9th of May at 7:30 in the evening. And we'll get into the detail of strolling magic and table hopping magic. I mentioned earlier in this podcast about when you have a new material putting into your act, how sometimes it can be difficult to actually go ahead and do it. But of course, actually finding suitable material can also be quite tricky sometimes, can't it? Especially if you've already got a lot of tricks that you already like. All the main theme, magical themes, if you like, you may have visited, you've got a book test. You know, you've got a blank deck routine or a colour changing deck routine. You know, you've got certain types, so you don't want another one of those because it would be too similar. So trying to find something can be quite problematical sometimes. Now, it might be that you're lucky. You may see something online, you may be reading a magazine or a book and come across something. But if you have to actually actively go out and search for something, then it can become quite difficult. And I think one of the reasons is because as magicians, we tend to pigeonhole magic. I mean, this was originally, I'm sure, done by magic dealers. Here's all the children's. Here are all the children's magic effects. Here's all the mental effects. Here are all the close-up magic tricks. So if you were going to a dealer and looking at an online catalogue or looking at a website and you went to that category under close-up magic, you'd expect to find all suitable tricks. Whereas actually the truth is, those tricks may be suitable in other circumstances. So a close-up trick, if you scale it up in the right way, can become a platform or a stand-up trick. A stage effect, if miniaturized or using different objects, can be scaled down to using close-up. I've used mental effects in children's shows by changing the nature of the mentalism is basically the same, but what the objects are that are being used are more appealing to young children. So it is a case sometimes of not thinking in a too restricted a way when you're looking for new material. Think in a broader way. You know, you might see an illusion on a stage. Well, you're not going to do the illusion in close-up, but it might give you an idea, what about if something did a similar sort of effect to one that is not necessarily even a scaled-down version, just a similar effect of some sort. It may inspire you to think, oh, I could do a close-up version of that. Instead of a sword going through something, I could have a needle going through it, you know, and make it all smaller. Now, John Graham's book, which is called Stage by Stage, which purports to tell you how to create good stand-up material, actually, that's what his book is all about. It's about upscaling close-up magic so that it becomes suitable for stand-up work. And it's a really interesting book, if that's the direction, if you like, from small to large that you want, or larger, that you want to go in. It's actually a very interesting book to look at. And it shows you what is possible. And I know that from my own perspective, I've never liked or used big props. What I've tended to do is I've tended to use small props. And if I'm on a stage, I'll get people up to help, or I'll just project it bigger. One of my favourite tricks to do on a stage, if I have to do a front of curtain type thing at a magic convention where I'm perhaps lecturing and then I need to do a stage spot as well, I'll do an effect where I get five spectators up from the audience. And the actual trick is very, very small. It's literally a ring on a padlock with some keys. But the presentation is really big, and it can fill an entire theatre. I've done it to 2,000 people, and the effect still registers well. It's very funny, so that helps. But also, they don't have to be able to see the props to appreciate the magic because of the way that it's structured. So I think if you're looking for new material and you think, I don't know, I seem to have done everything, look outside where you would normally look at children's tricks and think, can I use any of this in my stand-up act by changing the props? And vice versa. And it may well be that you'll discover some untapped riches in categories of magic that you never thought of before. And it's also a very good argument for, if you go to a magic convention, going to all the lectures, even ones that you don't think are going to have a subject matter that's of particular interest to you, well, that's not my area of interest, go anyway, because sometimes what somebody is saying that is not in your field of interest, you suddenly will spark, that's interesting, yes, I could do that in close-up. And then suddenly you have something that you can use. Well, thank you so much for listening to the latest podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it all. Have a good couple of months, and I'll see you on the next one. Bye for now.